Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular.
Sitting alongside Chief Operating Officer of Gateway Proven Strategies, CC Zach. Today, we are joined by a man who wears many hats, but for today's conversation, we're going to introduce him as CEO of Exchange Listing, Peter Goldstein. Peter, thank you for being here with us.
My pleasure, and thanks for having me.
And Peter, where are you today in the world?
I am actually calling you from Amsterdam, and I'm normally based in Southern California, but I have been positioned for 92 days now in Amsterdam, arrived here just before things really kind of started to spread rapidly with COVID, and am glad to be positioned here inside of the center of Amsterdam.
Well, I think when we first started recording this show, we did speak to a guest who was also in the Netherlands. And if you would briefly just tell us, over the last 90 days, has the situation gotten a little bit better, a little bit harder? Give us a quick update, if you would.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So it's very interesting. You know, when we arrived, really was the end of March. And at that point, the coronavirus was spreading quite rapidly in Europe. Many weeks before things really started to take off in the United States. And at the peak here, then in early April, it was quite serious with, you know, more than 3,000 people a day in Italy and Spain and the rest of Western Europe were dying daily, which was substantially higher toll than in the U.S. Over the past few months, however, Europe has really contained the virus. While the U.S., as we know, has its challenges. So, you know, overall, what I found here was that the people in Amsterdam were much more organized. The country, you know, really used a combination of what they called intelligent lockdowns, and that included, you know, public health guidance and testing and really, you know, had a plan. Now the good news here is that not just in Amsterdam, but larger parts of Europe have begun reopening, including schools, and so far, you know, without major new outbreaks. So, you know, that's kind of a current overview from April now till today. I will also share with you that I learned that myself and my daughter, who are traveling here, both tested positive for COVID and have the antibodies, and we're very fortunate to have a very minimal case and minimal side effects.
You know, Peter, just a quick question on the antibodies. Have they given you any direction on how to think through, now that you have them, how likely you are to get the virus? Because we've been getting mixed messages here in the States. I'd be curious to see what the Europeans have been saying if you test positive for the antibodies and you know, the future risk you have.
Yeah, similar mixed messages. It's really, I think, the truth is that nobody has, you know, the background to give the exact answer. So we're just continuing to be cautious and take precautionary methods. You know, here, you know, masks aren't mandatory unless you're on public transportation and other things. But generally speaking, I'm just as cautious as I was before I found out. But the medical doctors here don't have a lot of insight as to, you know, where I would stand now that we have the antibodies. And I'm an optimistic guy, so I'm going to take the high road and say that we had it and we were fortunate and the worst is behind us.
That's awesome to hear. So thank you for sharing that. You know, and Peter, it's so great to have you on the show because, as you know, I'm really have a passion around finding ways to change behavior to legitimize the cannabis industry. And with your background, you just have an extraordinary background, very eclectic leadership roles with a wide variety of skills and industries, so to speak. Can you tell us why you got into cannabis?
Yeah, so like you said, I have a bit of a varied background. I started as an entrepreneur over 30 years ago. I'm 57, so I started fairly young and have been involved in different sides of owning and operating businesses in different stages, including Wall Street background and capital market background, which when I really saw my passion was building companies. And what I saw with cannabis when things, I was living in Southern California at the time. And, you know, Southern California, California in general, the epicenter of, you know, the largest market to be anticipated in the United States. And at the time when recreational cannabis was approved legal, although I was a bit cautious, given some of the negative perceptions and perhaps maybe some of the legacy issues, I really got excited to see the opportunity to bring my experience and my business acumen to what is now, as we know, this, you know, burgeoning industry.
And you, would you share a little bit, if you can, about how, where you've made that entry point within cannabis?
So I started in compliance because I have, when I owned my, I owned a boutique investment bank, which I started from scratch and went through all of the regulatory compliance necessary to be licensed in the financial services industry. And I took that regulatory understanding and started to work with groups in regulatory and as an advisor and a consultant and looking at how to position companies in California who wanted to look at branding their products and their services and also marketing their products and services in a highly regulated environment. That was early on, and given my regulatory compliance, that was really kind of my entry point. And given that I started with compliance, I then learned much more about the industry, and truly that led to my appreciation for the plant. Compliance was a very complex, remains a very complex issue in the sector. I didn't have as much background and appreciation for the plant, for the culture of the people, especially in California, and the legacy and the value that, you know, is in the plant and the cannabinoids.
It's so funny that you mentioned the culture in California, because I think that that's one of the biggest unspoken challenges that I've had personally in my tenure within cannabis, is really adapting to the business savvy of this industry, or not per se, but helping others recognize the gap that they don't have, that they don't have the business savvy. So it's just funny that you mentioned the culture. Eric,
well,
you're not...
It's a big part.
Yeah, it sure is. And Eric's nodding his head up and down because I know he wants to say something about the culture.
Well, the culture is one thing, but I want to dive into the compliance piece a little bit, because on this topic of legitimizing cannabis, compliance remains to this day a big obstacle. And as you said, this is still a very highly regulated environment. And there are people who play by the rules. There are people who enjoy the gray area, it seems, a little bit. And, you know, when we look at how to legitimize this industry, what are the steps that cannabis owners, cannabis operators need to take in order to move toward that end goal? Give us your thoughts on the compliance piece of it. What do they need to be thinking about?
Well, the first thing is that there's going to be constant change. So, you know, that end goal, Eric, is different for everybody. You know, what I think we've all realized is it's not a one-size-fits-all for a company or for inside of what state you're in or even what municipality you're in, and then what aspect of the business you're in. So, you know, what's constant is that there's going to be changes in the need to be compliant and to stay on top of that. And that is really a dedicated role, obviously working with a good legal firm and with good legal advisors, as well as being active inside of the municipality, inside of the state that you're in, and working with, of course, you know, the regulators and the officials. There's no easy answer there. It's a constant, it requires a lot of work and a lot of attention. And it was because of this, actually, that helped me kind of see that there are these voids in the market where you may have experts who have an understanding in regulatory components, but they don't understand necessarily how to drive a startup or how to do capital formation. So in looking at all of weaving in those fabrics together is part of how companies, to, you know, the discussion points here, can really legitimize themselves and remain compliant. You either are or you're not. And in this environment, quite often the intentions for most companies are solid and they plan to be current with their compliance. But because it's constantly changing, it takes a tremendous amount of diligence and work and focus And that has nothing to do with the gray market and the black market. These are just for operators that really want to do everything right. And they come perhaps from a legacy perspective where they haven't had to do that before, or they're just new to the industry and have this learning curve that is steep for all of us because of the ongoing changes inside of regulatory compliance.
So you talk about that learning curve. If you were to have done things differently or involved different partners from when you got into cannabis to help you get up that learning curve faster, is there anything you would have done differently or any type of partner that you may have engaged in sooner than what you did?
It's a great question. You know, clearly having the right attorney who is current, specifically inside of the state that you're operating, and then also the local municipality, and then building a relationship and a set of ecosystems. It really is a lot about collaboration, not necessarily business collaboration, but on just sharing in the dialogue of what is happening, the ability to have that expertise, and then know that you're going to have to adapt. So, you know, I would start with legal as number one, and then I would move into collaboration with your municipality, the regulators inside of where you're operating, and more importantly, the companies and the professionals and the other people that are inside of the industry.
So what about the supply chain in all of this? Now, we talked about compliance. I know that you've moved on and are looking at brands. But where does supply chain fit into that ecosystem you talk about at an early stage?
I'm a fundamental businessman, so I think this is one of the places where I see, you know, where I bring value to the industry and where the industry really could use some benefit in looking. Supply chain, you know, it's a terminology that's thrown around a lot. Also, was vertical integration is thrown around quite often. But what does it really mean to me is that a company has thought through all of the different aspects of its business model. And in the early stages of this industry, I think people were more product-driven, perhaps more service-driven, but they didn't have perhaps the solid business plan and assumptions that include, TC, your question about the supply chain. So I think it's really important that if you have, as a business owner and a business team, and as you're building out your business to be sustainable, that you know those critical drivers. So supply chain has its own critical drivers in which is unique to each business, and that then thereby is the focus to be able to provide consistent quality service and products. Very difficult to have a sustainable business if the supply chain is breaking down at certain points along your business. And that's been a real issue in the industry, right? So now, like, for example, you know, as I have shifted my business model and the value that I provide, that's one of the areas that I focus on quite early, is very deliberately and very strategically to look at how can these companies be sustainable. And without an understanding of those strategic initiatives, including the supply chain, it's really hard for a small to medium-sized enterprise to be sustainable in this environment.
You know, Peter, I hope you don't mind, but I am going to go back to the recording and take down some of your words and quote you in the consulting business and the consulting world that I'm in right now, because that is the biggest challenge that I see with so many of our innovators, the cannabis entrepreneurs that just don't think through to the end goal that they're looking for. You know, what's the end goal that we have for our product, for our service, and work backwards. And you just articulated it so beautifully, and it's a wonderful skill that you have. I just wish that we could help more companies recognize that value proposition that you just articulated, which is the existence of our consulting firm here at GPS. But I just wanted you to know that I may be quoting Peter Goldstein as I'm talking to clients and helping them understand our service model.
I'm honored, of course, and you know, we share a very similar approach to bringing value to our clients, and you know, I actually use the working backwards as a critical piece before I start my work with a company. And that begins with, you know, the old adage, if you don't have a roadmap, you know, how do you know where you're going? And so an end game for a company can be very different. You know, are you just looking to build market share? do you have a defined exit strategy? You know, is that a merger? Is it a consolidation? You know, do you want to go public? Do you want to grow by a strategic partnership? And without that roadmap, then what you end up having is a lot of what is happening now that's not working in the industry. So, you know, I think what's really important, and as we look also to collaborate and bring more value to people in the industry, is ways that we can help them reach that. And starting with the end game and then working backwards is a perfect example.
Yeah, Peter, we really need to find more people, senior leaders like you, to come in and to reshape the acumen that is needed in this industry, because I haven't found many people like you in the industry. So it's great to have you here and so passionate about it. Now, I know you're working on a super secret project right now. I don't know how super secret it is, but is it something that you could tell our listeners about? Because I personally think it's extraordinary and can't wait to see it on the marketplace.
Well, thanks. Yeah, it's not top secret. I'm happy to share, the overview. And the overview is that, you know, this is a company, and one of the things that I really am attracted to in the industry right now is also part of the problem in the industry, is that there are companies and products that are more marketing-driven and less science-driven and have less known efficacy for the products that they're delivering to their consumers. So I look for large addressable markets where there is science and research to support claims that are not just marketing oriented. So I'm working, one of the reasons I'm in Amsterdam, the primary reason is that I'm working with a European company, and it's in the oral care segment. Oral care segment is a very large, you know, it's a $50 billion consumer product market. And the ongoing development of that company is about 2+ years of research and development to bring about the use of cannabinoids in oral care. And so we know that there are product benefits that are in cannabinoids that are antibacterial and antifungal, specifically here. These are oral care products that can be used both by consumers on a day-to-day basis, as well as medical professionals. And they are covered under intellectual property. And it was very interesting because this is a company that's different than what I've seen in the U.S. They started with the science. So they established an R&D facility. They worked with the local government to get licensed to research medical cannabis, and then actually began the first that we're aware of with real human biofilm studies using cannabinoids to see how it impacts individual human biofilm. So it's quite interesting. The results have been very significant as an antimicrobial product that has come from the combination of not just the cannabinoids, but cannabinoids combined with other natural ingredients and formulations. So that's the project that I'm working on. It's formulations are completed, patents are filed, and one has been issued and will be coming to market here, hopefully in the very near term, in a time where we're all faced with challenges in healthcare and the trends that are coming out through COVID, and finding ways to reduce anything that is antimicrobial or antiviral or beneficial to our health is such a critical time. So thanks for asking. It's a passion project for me, but also tells you a little bit about how I work, where I roll up my sleeves. I'll be acting as the interim CEO of the company to help and have taken the time during the pandemic to completely reshape their business model to have them ready to go to market really here in the next short term, in the next 60 to 90 days.
And I'd like to tell our listeners that I have been privy to this project, and it is extraordinary. It is like nothing out there today. So, for all of you listening, keep your eyes and ears out for a dental care line that is based in Europe, because I think we'll see it on the marketplace pretty darn quickly. And it's going to be a gold standard, I believe, in professional and consumer dental care as we go forward. Peter, just one other thing that you said that strikes me. And I think for those that are listening that know me at all, the science is at the core of everything I do. And so it's just interesting that you have found that the science is being done in Europe. Can you comment why you don't see science really burgeoning here in the United States at all? And is that something that we could be doing or pushing to legitimize the perception and ultimately the commercialization of cannabis in the U.S. or North America?
I can't necessarily answer as to why. I think they're just maybe more of a orientation in Europe around, you know, research and development and science, and specifically where this, you know, company is located. It's known as an R&D area for, you know, pharmaceutical and for other factors that are based more on R&D and looking for the science to support products, where U.S., generally speaking, maybe more oriented about bringing products to market faster and more marketing oriented. I think one of the topics of this discussion is about how can the industry be more legitimate. And I think maybe one of your pet peeves as well as mine is the lack of transparency and, you know, claims that may be made by certain products. Here, I think what was attractive to me was that there is efficacy, there is dosing, there's consistency. You know, there's third-party lab testing. So the claims that are being made are supported, whereas there are a lot of products on the market that, in the U.S. especially, I see that, and here in Europe as well, that are having claims and may provide certain benefits, but may not because they haven't been studied in such a way. And I also, you know, we all realize it's early in the industry. So studies, I know, are happening. Of course, there is short-term, more consumer-based. I'd say there's mid-term, it's more medical-based. And then there's the long-term, with your background, CCM, the pharmaceutical. Those take a long period of time, right? So, you know, what's really important is that consumers are seeing benefits from, and I'm more talking about the CBD side of things, where they're seeing benefits from anxiety and sleep and pain. But they don't know what's in the products that they're taking because the claims and the labels and the transparency and the formulations are inconsistent from product to product or batch to batch.
Well, very, very interesting work that you're doing, and we can't wait to learn more about it. I do want to ask you one question, though, because I would feel like we missed an opportunity if we didn't ask you this. You talked about collaboration, and I really liked what you were saying about engaging with policymakers, which I think is a very important thing to do. We've seen that here in Colorado through the CHAMP initiative, where the state wanted stakeholders in this industry to come and educate policymakers to kind of help guide the policy, because more often than not, with an industry that is this nuanced and the science around all this stuff, the policymakers really don't know that much about it. They're not dealing with it every day. So I think there's a lot to be said for that. But on another topic of collaboration, with your background in mergers and acquisitions and consolidation, how do you think COVID and this pandemic and the financial hit a lot of cannabis businesses have taken, do you think we will see more M&A here in the next 6 months to a year? You know, you have a long, rich history watching these things unfold. So give us your prediction, if you would.
Absolutely. I see there being more consolidation across the board. Even pre-COVID, we saw, you know, the trend going towards consolidation. And a lot of that consolidation was more at the high level of the larger companies and larger financed and well-capitalized companies. I think now more and more, I see this gap. I see the gap where you have great innovators and entrepreneurs, you know, who have had either legacy products or even new entries into the market as one group. And then you have another with the investors who have put capital to work and have a portfolio of companies and you know, made a look to need to see how those can collaborate together. And then, of course, I think there's some input from the incumbents, you know, who want to enter the market and may have, you know, the ability to see consolidation working the benefit of building more sizable and sustainable companies. So I'm very bullish on the fact that there will be more and more consolidation. Where I see it changing is that it's not just at the top high end of the spectrum, that, and it, maybe it's because I'm a little biased, honestly, because my orientation, I love entrepreneurs. I love to work in, you know, hands-on with entrepreneurs and small to medium-sized companies. And that's where I see the consolidation happening more and more, where you're building not economies of scale, but economies of scope inside of consolidation. So really there to me is going to be more and more activity, and that could have variations, right? It could be that, you know, those are strategic partners or joint ventures, you know, they're or in the way of mergers and acquisitions. It may be that, you know, we're combining competencies here, or we are looking to scale. And then the obvious of there may be some distressed assets that are just, you know, logical for other parties to consolidate into, to accelerate and not have to, you know, look to do on their own. There's been a lot of capital deployed previously that may not be able to be sustainable with that company as a standalone entity. But if it's consolidated with another and adds in a piece of that, you know, value chain, as we were talking about earlier, then it just seems to be very logical. You know, again, I go back to fundamentals. And if collaboration can happen on the higher level of companies, then it certainly can happen down on the small to medium-sized sector where the supply chain comes together in what I like to call more economies of scope than economies of scale. And I'm very excited about that. It's something that I didn't plan to participate in directly in helping companies to see how they can be sustainable by that form of consolidation and collaboration, and is really, to me, part of the, I think, the next wave of growth, whether you want to call this cannabis 2.0 or 3.0. I see that as an ongoing trend and a benefit to everybody in the industry.
Peter, I love it. I mean, I love the science. I love the business acumen. I love the consolidation and the M&A component of the, what are the unspoken virtues that need to occur to be successful. And what I also love, which I'm going to start quoting you on, is economies of scope versus economies of scale, because I do think that really hits the nail as to how do we help these innovators in the cannabis field recognize what their value proposition is to everyone else versus what they think it is to everyone else. And you hit the nail on the head with me with economies of scope. So I promise I will have you in quotes. Peter Goldstein said it, not CC Zach.
Peter, it has been.
I love it. Well,
go ahead.
No, it's a pleasure to be able to chat with you both, and it's easy when you're talking among like-minded professionals.
Absolutely, and we can't wait both for the super secret project that is, it sounds imminent. And when you are back in the States, if you decide to come back, I don't know, maybe it's just really nice over there, and you know, it'd be nice to stay, but we would love to get together and have you here in the studio with us and continue the conversation, because there's a lot more ground to cover.
Look forward to it. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, Peter, thank you.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. Do you have any ideas for episode topics or guests? We would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.